Welcome to The Virtual Shift, a show looking at the seismic changes happening in healthcare with virtual care at the epicenter. Join me and my guests as we look at key cultural and policy shifts impacting how providers, payers, and patients connect, as well as how care is being reimagined both for today and the future. Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Tom Foley. You can learn more about this show by visiting the program on healthcarenowradio.com, and be sure to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, @FoleyTom. And the hashtag, The Virtual Shift. We have two special guests today, Lucy Zielinski and Daniel Marino. Both are managing partners at Lumina Health Partners and hosts of the podcast, Value-Based Care Insights. You can find their podcast on Healthcare Now Radio. Lucy and Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
So I read an article, and the article was entitled, Telehealth Primed for Growth. And you were both mentioned in that article, and I thought, hey, let's talk about that. So let's start off because, you know, there's a lot of discussion about telehealth, and it has different meanings for a lot of different people. So Lucy and Dan, give us your definition of telehealth.
Telehealth has really exploded, as you know, as a result of COVID. And what it's allowed for is physicians to have a direct interaction with their patients. So the way that we think about it is you have the in-person model where patients actually come to see the physician and take care of services. And then you have the virtual model. And within the virtual model, telehealth is a component of that. So we sort of see telehealth as sort of a subcomponent of the virtual health activity that's occurring, providing for another level of patient-physician interaction that's occurring in the care model.
What I hear is from the market is when you mentioned telehealth, we're really talking about a video engagement. So you kind of distinguish that, Dan, from telehealth video engagement, and I'm sure you meant asynchronous and synchronous type of engagements as well, versus virtual care. What's your distinction? How do you define virtual care?
Virtual care is much broader. So what we're starting to see is, you're right, you're going to have your video visits or your telehealth visits, but there's a lot of other activities that's now folding into the virtual healthcare model, if you will. So for instance, new technologies around the integration of wearables is really playing well into the virtual health model. And especially as you start to think about moving into value-based care, it rounds out the physician's ability to truly provide more comprehensive care to the patient outside of the traditional model that would occur in the office, and even the traditional model of care management, if you will, really integrating a lot of these other elements that are really virtual in nature into the overall care model.
Yeah, and I think, Dan, just to add to that point, if we take a look at the coverage with CMS, they've expanded their codes, their coverage, their payment to physicians for all sorts of services. I mean, be it not only telemedicine, virtual visits like we're talking about, but also some of the remote patient monitoring, therapeutic monitoring, and then expanding even other specialists to do these video visits with patients. So we've seen quite a bit of expansion in the payments from CMS, and other commercial payers are following.
I couldn't agree more with you, Lucy. And I think the way CMS has stepped in on many different fronts during the pandemic as well as post-pandemic has really been a differentiator in this re-transformation of the delivery of care. As you both know, remote patient monitoring came out just at the end of 2018, I believe. So, you know, the pandemic picked up in 2020, and, you know, so there really wasn't a lot of focus on it, right? There was other worries. So now that we're in post-pandemic, and from a telehealth perspective, I think your article records that there's 89% satisfaction rate amongst consumers. So that's, I always refer to an old commercial, you know, Mikey likes it. So that's a good thing, right? And then fast forward, we got remote therapeutic monitoring that was new in the physician fee schedule in 2022. And we have chronic care management. In our preamble, we talked about my classic model of why do we need to change? And, you know, I talk about my listeners hear it all the time. average Medicare patient, 5 chronic conditions, 9 different doctors, only in front of their doctor 15 hours in a given year. So the big question in my eyes is what happens the other 8,745 hours? You both mentioned value-based care. And I guess I want to ask the question is value-based care pre-COVID a result of a lack of patient engagement and a way of facilitating better engagement versus some of the models that are available now post-COVID? Thoughts?
Yes. When you think about value-based care and what had occurred pre-COVID, convenience was a big part of that. But I think the other driver was that the realization by the industry that we need to deliver care differently. We need to bring down costs. We need to add convenience, to your point, Tom. But we also have to provide much more integrated, efficient care. And we need to do it by tracking the outcomes of the patient, not just looking at the number of patients that are seen in the physician's office. So as we fast forward to post-COVID, those three elements of convenience, integrated care, and managing a lot of the financial components related to the care delivery models has really exacerbated the push into value-based care. And I think for many organizations, it's forced them to really think about their delivery model differently, their reimbursement differently, their compensation to their physicians differently, and really even structuring the way that they're interacting with patients much different than it was before.
Post-COVID, we now have, telehealth. Consumers seem to like it. Remote patient monitoring, which now starts to engage that patient a bit more in monitoring the physiological elements of their state of health. And then we have remote therapeutic monitoring, which is non-physiological, pain levels, med adherence, things of that nature. And then we have chronic care management, a care manager that ultimately is engaging that patient on a day-to-day basis. So, if I had 2 or more chronic conditions, I could be subscribed into all 3 of those models, inclusive of using the 4th model of telehealth, a video encounter. So and it's all about the home being that setting of care, in my view. I'm struggling with the idea of, and I'm not opposed to value-based care, trust me, but I see this new model as being a really great model of engaging that patient, closing that 8,745-hour gap, and moving them towards a state of wellness without taking on any risk. Any thoughts, Lucy?
Yes. The goal at the end of the day is about improving patient outcomes, right? I think we can all agree about that.
Absolutely.
And the payment models must follow.
Nothing happens in healthcare unless there's a CPT code.
That's right. A payable CPT code. Exactly. And being a certified coder, I know that well, how to get paid. So, I think it's good, being able to deliver good care to the patient and being able to deliver good care early enough to prevent chronic conditions, prevent those readmissions, prevent complications. So in the past, I don't know that we paid enough attention as medical providers in that wellness space, in the prevention space. And we've seen that evidence even with CMS, with the annual wellness visits. I mean, those are, a few years old. They're not that old. I mean, 20 years ago, there was no such thing as an AWV. And so I think as an industry, we're seeing more of that to prevent that long-term cost, trying to reduce that medical spend long-term.
I agree. Your thoughts, Dan?
I agree with what Lucy said. We really do have to follow where the reimbursement is coming from. And with many of the payers interacting with the providers, the payers are shifting the risk to the providers, to the healthcare organizations, to the physicians. And it's a scary time for providers. It's a scary time for physicians in particular. And I think as we incorporate a lot of these new services of virtual health, of telehealth and telemedicine, of being able to manage patients differently, interact with patients differently, that's what's going to allow physicians, healthcare providers to become more comfortable in assuming different levels of risk.
Interesting. So, Dan, you wrote an article, albeit back in October of 2018, a blueprint for building risk-ready healthcare organization. It's a great read. You can find it on Dan's LinkedIn profile. And in there, you establish, it says creating infrastructure requires a focus on developing four cornerstone capabilities: contract modeling and negotiations, care management and coordination, analytics and technology, and relationships and alignment. I'm not looking to beat a dead horse here, but it would seem to me like those last three are very much akin to what's possible without taking on risk when you adopt telehealth, remote patient monitoring, remote therapeutic monitoring, chronic care management. Your thoughts?
Oh, you're absolutely right. You can do those last three without assuming any risk in a contract whatsoever. But if you're a healthcare provider, if you're a healthcare organization who's starting to assume a certain level of risk for a number of attributed lives, if you will, and you have a portion of your reimbursement tied to some level of performance outcomes, you need to think about all four of those elements in order to drive to that level of success. The other piece, and this is what Lucy had mentioned as well, using the modeling, using the way that you're interacting with your physicians and even with your patients starts to align the incentives. And as you start to think about that, you then could create the right level of outcomes, focusing on delivering the most efficient care to patients, meeting the patients where they're at in their risk model or in terms of where their chronic needs are and what have you. You just do a better job of delivering that overall care.
Interesting. So let's change the topics a bit, Lucy, to what you said. This is really about how do we do a better job in getting to outcomes, one. Two, how do we not shift, because we have a huge population that has been through their years and now have chronic conditions and they need to be cared for, but we need to shift the thinking to wellness. So that's another shift in the market. When we talk about reimagining the delivery of care, we also have to reimagine, and even us as consumers need to take on more responsibility. And I say that in the context of, in today's model, 50% of all prescriptions, believe it or not, never filled. And my med adherence is in the tank. So I go through the challenge of going to the doctors, getting diagnosed, getting the script. Either I don't fill it, and if I do fill it, it's only for the first 30 days, and I'm off regimen already, right? And I'm not paying attention to my diet and exercise, right? So we have a lot of responsibility. Because I always say a provider can't get the value unless a patient gets the wellness. Those have to be done in parallel. And I often say, you know, Thanksgiving dinner, Christmas, Easter, whatever, the holiday, 4th of July, talk to your friends that come to your party and ask them whether or not they even know what value-based care is. It tells me that there's still a misalignment between what the providers and healthcare systems need to do versus what my responsibilities are as the consumer. So, and I think that there's a challenge there. Any thoughts on how we can close that particular gap in getting the consumer more engaged? Now, we have some opportunities here with new programs. That's one way, but still, it's a mindset. It's a behavioral change. Any thoughts on thinking about wellness versus living life out with chronic conditions?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. Yeah, I just think of the one of the pushbacks with meaningful use when providers had to use a patient portal, right, to communicate information and have patients follow it, certain protocols, and providers were dinged because they could not control whether a patient, one, was engaged or would follow or adhere to certain treatment protocols. And providers would scratch their head and say, I can't move the bar on those measures because that's the patient's responsibility. And they were absolutely right. They were absolutely right. And I think there lays in the conundrum, like whose fault is it or who's accountable for that? And the patient definitely needs to be accountable and has responsibility for that. I think a couple of the ways, I think we're starting to see the shift in some of this where patients are more educated now. We know that BMIs are high. We know that, you know, our health, our what we do and what we don't do, whether or not we take medication and take care of ourselves, like you said, impacts our health. So I think that educational piece is important. I think another piece is important is access to our information from the providers. I mean, before, did we ever get the after visit summaries? No, we never saw what the doctor may say a couple of things like, hey, you know, go exercise and eat better. We heard that all the time,
exactly.
Right? But yes. Now they may be poking at us. They may be poking. It might come through the portal. It might be a social media piece. It might be on Facebook. And the providers and the payers are even poking us. They'll give us incentives. A $10, $20 off this or off that if we comply or it's not part of the deductible. So I think we're starting to see some shifts in the industry to educate and to engage and to promote wellness with patients.
I agree. When you see Fitbits and Apple Watches on the wrist of folks, you know that the shift is starting to occur towards wellness. My daughter-in-law, however, she's who eats very healthy, is not allowed at Thanksgiving dinner because, no, just joking. So you mentioned access. It begs the question, you know, given today's challenge with access to care, I was in meaningful use too. I worked for NextGen, Allscripts, Cerner. I have the EHR background. I was the meaningful use subject matter expert for the Pop Health for meaningful use stage two. But the point there being is I'm starting to hear, you know, patient engagement has been the talking point since 2010. And 12 years later, we're still here trying to fix the problem. The point there is that is access, now we have everybody talking about improving access. Is access the problem or access to a cure or access to the prescription, if you will, the problem? And the point there being is, can I afford the prescription? Can I afford that diet that my doctor is telling me to go on? Can I actually do the exercises that I need to do? Do you think that's part of the problem?
I'll jump in. I think when you think about access, I think it's multifaceted. I think one component of access is focusing on different types of engagement opportunities that you have with the patients, meeting the patient where they are within their lifestyle and within their health condition. The traditional model of calling up, getting on the phone and calling the patient or calling the physician and scheduling a visit is still important. But if that is your only access alternative, then you're going to be limited in really being able to meet the true needs of the patient. So you need to expand the different ways to engage the patient through different levels of access. Telehealth, you know, as you said, Tom, direct outreach through email, through texting, and then giving patients different alternatives to connect with a provider that still allows you to kind of manage it. I think the other piece that you had mentioned, which I really find interesting, is sort of the issues around, I don't know if it's health equity or if it's really the social determinant factors that may limit the patient's ability to actually act on whatever is being prescribed or whatever is being provided to the patient from the physician, sometimes due to a number of socioeconomic issues, demographic issues, or whatever the case may be, they just can't do it. Does that affect access? Well, absolutely. And I think that is something that we really have to take into consideration as well.
Yeah, and Dan, I think just to add to that point, as an industry, I think we're doing a much better job with the data that we have, with data analytics, because the data is informing us of who those patients are that are frequent flyers and what's going on, and we can better manage those patients. Case in point, one of the clinics I was working at had a frequent flyer in the ER, this patient, and they scratched their heads and wondered, why is he keep on going to the ER? He's complaining of pain. Come to find out, long story short, he's homeless and he wanted a warm dinner. He didn't have food. So that was such a quick fix. The clinic ended up spending, I think, a couple hundred dollars and taking care of a few things, and he stopped going to the emergency room. But it's only because they looked at the data.
That's an interesting story, Lucy. And yeah, I think that, so we're doing a lot of good stuff, right? We're closing the 8,745-hour gap. We're engaging the patient better. We're trying to provide the greater access to care. regardless of socioeconomic influences. And, you know, we still, at the end of the day, with all that good stuff, we have some other macro trends that are really showing themselves post-COVID, right? I used to say pre-COVID, we have, it doesn't matter what geography you're in, we have a growing population, an aging population, population that's contracting more chronic conditions, older age or sicker population. And we had less doctors, and we have less doctors and nurses, and that was pre-COVID, right? So in this article, it says that the shortage of clinical and administrative support staff and the emergence of new consumers who has new and different expectations, providers continue to grapple with the norm in healthcare, where telehealth stands ready to play a major role. Point there being is we have older age or sicker population. We have a gap in engagement, and we have less doctors and nurses. It seems to me like it is in fact the recipe, and those are the things that we have to address first in how we reimagine this delivery of care. We have to change, in my view, we have to change the rules a bit to address all these different social economic factors, resource factors, and now with, you know, hospitals being grappling with not only resource shortages, but cost of resources, it just seems that we need to think differently. And I guess I'm asking, the question is this virtual care model enough? Is the swing to value-based care enough? What if you were a regulator, how would you advise change in regulations to truly transform the market? Thoughts there, Dan?
Well, when you look at a few of the healthcare providers around the country who have been incorporating aspects of clinically integrated care for their physicians and with their hospitals, they have been able to demonstrate that they can deliver high quality care at a lower cost point than those that have fragmented care. So then the question becomes, as you said, how do you get the other organizations to sort of jump on the bandwagon? And I believe that the true way of being able to do that is you have to create the right in financial incentives. You have to have the right level of reimbursement that's going to incentivize that. The government's been trying to do that. That's really around what the ACO is. And when you look at the ACO compared to straight fee-for-service or commercial contracts, there has been benefits associated with higher quality care delivered at a lower cost point. So I think unless you have the financial incentives, unless you have the reimbursement model that's going to provide the right direction to transition into value-based care, unless you have all of that, folks are still going to get stuck in the fee-for-service world. And that's what we're seeing now.
Yeah, I still think, I don't disagree with anything you said, Dan, but what is always missing is what's the incentive for the consumer? Value-based care is a provider-centric incentive, not a consumer-centric incentive. So we need to get consumers empowered and engaged to drive a different outcome. That, to me, personally, it's the missing link. If we're really going to shift the market, we have to shift the consumer's mindset in that they have a responsibility too. You could talk about all you want about a single payer system and things of that nature, but the facts still hold true. You have a responsibility to change your own outcomes.
I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting next couple of years. You guys are really spot on with what you're doing. I appreciate your time on the program. Any last words, Lucy, before we go?
Oh, I have a few words. So I think providers should definitely stay ahead of this curve. The way healthcare is being delivered today is changing. And they must go along with the flow and adopt, because you're seeing a lot of other companies that are going into the space. I mean, we see it. I think all of us see it. So, and providers need to definitely tap into some of the new services, into virtual care, as well as what Dan was talking about. Be a participant in these provider networks to be able to leverage a larger network in some of the services around care management, across multiple specialties, et cetera, just to deliver better patient care. Because that's really the goal you're trying to achieve, is healthier patients, right? Better care for patients at a reduced cost.
Awesome. Dan?
Yeah, I agree with Lucy. I think it's our job, all of our job, to help consumers see different types of care models, to be engaged with their own health, with their own wellness. I think it's also our jobs to help physicians think about delivering care differently, and to focus on really getting back to why they got into medicine to begin with. And that's really on delivering high quality care to patients. Somewhere along the way, the whole business side got in the way. So if we can really think through aligning the right level of incentives, getting back to the core of really delivering high quality care to these patients, creating a reimbursement structure that provides the incentives allowing all of us to be successful, you know, it's a lofty goal, but I think a goal that's important for all of us nonetheless.
We'll have to leave it there. Lucy Zielinski, Managing Partner of Lumina Health Partners, and Daniel Marino, Managing Partner of Lumina Health Partners as well. I appreciate you being on the program. Have a great day. I want to thank the show sponsors, HP. HP Engage Long Lifecycle Products provides the stability, safety, and security you need, plus flexibility and performance designed for today and tomorrow. As well, GenieMD, providing a modular, scalable, and customizable virtual care platform and clinical services to help providers extend care into the home, increasing access and quality while driving new revenue opportunities. If you missed part of today's episode, you can tune in at the same time, 11 a.m. or 7 p.m. Eastern, throughout the week, and be sure to check out the program page on healthcarenowradio.com. And remember, connect or follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter at Foley Tom, and follow the show's hashtag, The Virtual Shift. I'm Tom Foley. Until the next shift.